Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Hello, everybody. Labor Day weekend 2013 could be remembered for barbecues and bombs. Analysts were saying that Britain's rejection of military action against Syria could allow President Obama to launch an attack sooner than he would have if he had to wait for final British approval, which would have come next week. Council on Foreign Relations President Richard Haass has an op-ed in the Financial Times today that warns against the drift toward isolationism that the British Parliament vote represents to him. He's also the author of the book, Foreign Policy Begins at Home, and joins us now. Mr. Haass, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks. Good to be back.
And is it isolationism in Britain, or is it a simple demand that evidence be presented before authorizing military action, not after?
I don't think you can see this in isolation, so to speak, from a larger trend of a reduction in military spending, a reduction in a world role, a willingness to separate itself from the United States on important foreign policy questions. So I'm not denying your argument that there's something to do with the specifics here, but I also think this snapshot is part of a moving picture of an evolution in Britain's relationship with the world and its changing political culture.
On the particular issue at hand, here's a clip of Labour Party leader David Miliband before the raucous floor debate yesterday talking about the sequence of evidence before authorization.
I didn't think that that decision should be made on an artificial timetable when the House of Commons wouldn't even have seen the evidence today from the United Nations weapons inspectors. I'm determined we learn the lessons of the past, including Iraq, and we can't have the House of Commons being asked to write a blank check to the Prime Minister for military action.
So as it pertains to the UK, as it pertains to the US today, why shouldn't evidence before authorization be a basic protocol, especially after the Iraq war debacle of finding no WMDs after cutting off the weapons inspector's work 10 years ago?
Well, a couple of things. First, yes, you should look at the evidence before you make your decisions, but we need to keep a couple of things in mind. First, the weapons inspectors are not going to be able to tell you who used chemical weapons and why. The most they're likely to be able to tell you is that chemical weapons were, in fact, used. So they're not going to settle the debate. That's why you have an intelligence community that reaches judgments. And these judgments are rarely 100% ironclad, but rather based upon various sources, including the so-called intercept of this communications between a senior Iraqi figure and people in the field. They will put together what they believe is the best analysis or best explanation of what exactly happened. That won't be enough for some. It should be, though, because if you demand 100% certainty in your intelligence before you act, you're not going to do a lot of acting in the world, and that, too, has consequences.
What do you think, then, are the lessons of Colin Powell's disastrously inaccurate presentation of WMD evidence to the world on February 5th, 2003, which was followed almost immediately by the start of the Iraq War?
Well, two things. First of all, my own view is the people who favored that war did so for many reasons. Weapons of mass destruction, or the belief that weapons of mass destruction were there, was simply one of them and was not the most powerful. I believe that the Bush administration wanted to go to war in part after 9/11 to show that the United States was not a pitiful, helpless giant. In part because the president had been led to believe that Iraq would be easily transformed into a democracy, and that would set an example the rest of the region would not be able to resist emulating. So regardless of what happened with weapons of mass destruction at the UN and all that, I believe the administration would have gone to war. I did not support it at the time, even though I was a part of it, but that, as they say, is history. The larger lesson about intelligence is that simply assumptions can really distort things. So people assumed that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, and when they interpreted specific pieces of intelligence, they did it with that mindset. They did it through that filter. And one of the things people need to take away is that assumptions can be very dangerous things, and you've really got to challenge your assumptions every inch of the way. I do not believe, let me just make it clear, I do not believe there was any systematic or any whatsoever lying. What it was, again, was an intelligence failure of analysis no more and no less.
I don't want to spend a lot of time on that history, but didn't Colin Powell conclude that there was lying to him, not by him, but to him, that he was misled?
Not to my knowledge. That, again, he was presented the information. People may have emphasized certain things. I've never heard him use, I could be wrong here, and I did work for him, that people were lying to him. Again, I think people put forward the information as they saw it at the time. George Tenet was sitting there behind them, as you recall, or represented at that moment the best judgment of the intelligence community. It simply turned out to be wrong.
And I may be recalling that wrong, too. Richard Haass, my guest on WNYC Now, the president of the Council on Foreign Relations, as we talk about the Syria crisis. And listeners, are you becoming convinced with the evidence that is starting to emerge publicly, and the Obama administration will apparently declassify more of it today, that the Assad regime did use chemical weapons in Syria last week? And if so, what should the U.S. do about it? And a related question, you heard what happened in the U.K. Should the Obama administration also go through Congress and respect its wishes one way or the other? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Richard Haass, I'm going to play one more time the clip of Prime Minister Cameron that has been ringing around the world today on respecting the will of the British people.
It is clear to me that the British Parliament, reflecting the views of the British people, does not want to see British military action. I get that, and the government will act accordingly.
David Cameron last night. So, in your opinion, should President Obama give the same deference to the will of the American people as expressed through Congress?
I would not recommend it. Under our political system, the president has this degree of latitude. Under the War Powers Act, he is meant to notify Congress within, I think it is, 48 hours of committing U.S. forces into situations of combat. So I would think that would be sufficient. He would be foolish not to consult with Congress, and he is consulting with Congress quite broadly. But I would think that is adequate. I don't think we need or should put to a vote every single action of American national security policy.
Why wouldn't that be a better way to go? Why shouldn't we conclude that the UK is more of a principled country than we are when it comes to war and democracy?
Well, again, I'm not sure this is quote-unquote that big. The administration seems to be intent not on a broad-based or open-ended participation in the Syrian civil war. Rather, they're talking about, and I believe developing, quite a limited circumscribed option, and most several days of largely cruise missile strikes. So, again, there's an awful lot of political and foreign policy practice here of precedent, where the executive branch enjoys considerable latitude, and if they go to Congress on this decision, then are they beholden to go to Congress for every change in the policy? I simply don't think it's a sustainable course of action for carrying out a foreign policy.
Is it that easy to say, though, that this would be so limited? If we attack Syria, for example, many people think Syria will cynically attack Israel. So what's your scenario for the mission if Syria does respond by attacking Israel or by upping its domestic chemical attacks after we have promised a limited assault?
Well, I would be surprised if Syria attacked Israel simply because the Israelis have tremendous capabilities to bring to bear and I believe would have few qualms about doing so. Now, if the Syrians use chemicals again, and they may well, this is not the first time they use them, and may well not be the last time they use them, then it seems to me the United States ought to reserve the right to go back and inflict additional damage on Syria at a time of our own choosing against targets of our own choosing. And indeed, I would recommend if I were working for the president, which I'm obviously not, but if I were, then in any statement he would make that would accompany any limited use of force, that he would make clear to the American people, but also to the Syrian government and the world, that this was not necessarily a one-time thing. These are punitive strikes. These are meant to penalize and to inflict pain and cost upon, in this case, the government of Syria for having done this thing. And implicit in that, or explicitly, he should make clear that if they were to do something like this again, that the United States would reserve the right again to retaliate or respond in a manner of its own choosing.
Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations and author of the book Foreign Policy Begins at Home, urging the U.S. to take military action in Syria and warning against the creeping isolationism that the British Parliament vote last night represents. Vicky in the Bronx, you're on WNYC. Hello, Vicky. Vicky, are you there? All right, we'll try to come back to Vicky. How about Dan in Port Washington? Dan, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go ahead.
Good morning. I'm calling to really congratulate the British Parliament for having what appears to be an open and honest debate and discussion on the issue. Apparently, David Cameron was all set to engage in some retaliatory action, but was really stopped by the will of the British Parliament. And my point is that I think that the War Powers Act that we have in this country is flawed, that allows the president to act without that prior consultation of Congress. And it would be my fervent hope that we would have a British-style debate in our Congress prior to taking any such action.
Thank you very much. And obviously, Richard Haass disagrees with that, as we went over before. We'll go on to Carol in Manhattan.
Well, just to be clear, I don't disagree with the need for consultation or with debate. What I question is the need to get a formal approval by Congress for every course of action the U.S. government would take.
But having, what's the point
having
of
consultation?
What's the point of consultation or debate if it's meaningless and the administration is going to do whatever it's going to do anyway?
Well, because that's not the purpose of consultation. Consultation is not notification. It's also an exchange of views, and the administration may come away with it with a better sense of either what to do, and might also get a better sense of what might be politically sustainable. So it would be foolish if it didn't learn from any exchange with the Congress.
Simeon in Morristown. You're on WNYC. Hello, Simeon.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. The first place that I'd like just to talk about a little bit is the, you know, contrasting with Iraq. I mean, when we went into that conflict, when we went in there and invaded Iraq, there really were no use of chemical weapons at that time. What we did is go in on an assumption or on what we had as far as information that they had the chemical weapons. We invaded this country, we toppled the regime, and then we left them pretty much in a pretty bad state of affairs. So I understand where we would have any type of real, you know, having any type of, you know, going in there right now and just trying to figure out what we're going to do with any type of plan if we do go in and what we're going to do. But the real thing is that with the chemical weapons, can there be any doubt? I mean, with what's happened now, as we see these videos coming out of there, video after video of these people who are dead that don't have any injuries. I mean, is there any doubt that chemical weapons were used, and would these rebels use them against their own people?
Richard Haass, you want to answer that question?
Sure.
I guess if there's any doubt, it certainly seems on the face of it, quite convincing that it would have been the Assad regime. But then again, you don't know in the chaos of what's going on, if you're a casual outsider like most Americans, whether the rebels may have obtained some of those chemicals, even some of the rockets that seem to have been used to deliver the chemicals, or if there's another report that's not exactly who did it, but that says perhaps the Syrians intended to use chemical weapons, but not to that degree, and that Assad was surprised by that. So there is a certain fog of war. How certain are you? What have you seen in your, relatively privileged position as former government official and president of the Council on Foreign Relations?
I don't have, and I don't see how anyone can have any doubt about whether chemical weapons were used. Seems to me that's 100% certain. The only question is who used them and what degree of authority they had to use them. And there is some grayness. But it looks as though, based upon the way the weapons were delivered, using the shells and known to be in the inventory of the Syrian army, given the communications intercept, that these were used by the government. There's no evidence that I'm aware of that suggests the opposition had access to them or were using them. What you suggest is quite possible, though, that there had been some low-level uses previously of chemical weapons, if you will, under the radar, and that this use was much greater, and the local officials on the ground, either through incompetence or design, may have done something on a much larger scale than the authorities wanted, precisely leading to the debate we are now having. That doesn't excuse it. It's simply, but that is certainly a possibility.
You wrote an op-ed in the Financial Times last week that if we don't follow through on this red line warning about chemical weapons that the president made last summer, it makes all red line warnings, like on Iran's nuclear program, empty. But why is that true? This one is this one, and that one would be that one in a different situation.
It's very hard to selectively narrowcast and basically say, this time I mean it, even if the other time I said never mind. People tend to judge you by the pattern of behavior. So a president ought to keep in mind that when he says something in one context towards one audience, it's often heard in others. The days of smoke-filled rooms, so to speak, are over. And look, it gives the administration a challenge. They've got to keep in mind the need to make good on red lines. They've got to do something sufficiently robust so that people aren't prone to use chemical weapons again. On the other hand, they've got to put a ceiling on what they do because they don't want to get heavily embroiled in a Syrian civil war. It's not an easy policy to come up with something that checks all those boxes. That's both enough and not too much. The only thing I'd suggest, Brian, is the idea of thinking about, here's what we do with the direct military strikes, and we try to accomplish other things using other tools, whether it's arming the opposition or helping the refugees, that our answer to the CW strikes, to the chemical strikes by Syria, need not be, indeed should not be, the totality of our policy. We can, if you will, have different tools trying to accomplish different things here.
If President Obama thinks U.S. military involvement in Syria is a bad idea, which he has apparently thought all along, at least until this week, then maybe the mistake was making that rigid red line statement in the first place. So if he still thinks military action is a bad idea, why compound the red line statement mistake with an ill-advised military strike?
Well, I'm not sure the military strike is ill-advised. I don't think it would be.
From his point of view.
But whether he made the red line comment or not, I would still think the United States has a strong interest in seeing that the taboo of chemical weapons is not violated. So the fact that he made the red line comment adds to the stakes for the reasons we just discussed. It puts more of U.S. credibility at stake, not just in Syria, but in places like Iran or North Korea. But again, even if he'd never said any of those things, I still believe there's a strong case that the United States ought not to look the other way when chemical weapons are used by Syria or anybody else.
We just got word from Politico that Secretary of State Kerry has scheduled a 12:30 public statement about the situation in Syria. Do you have any prediction about what he'll say at that time?
No, sir. I not only did I have a prediction, I don't have the faintest idea.
You think he'll announce that the missiles are en route?
I would be very surprised if a Secretary of State were to announce that. It would be inappropriate.
It would be
That's
for the president.
Saying, be for the president initially, and then the Pentagon would give a briefing. Mm-hmm. I would think the Secretary of State would be much more likely to talk about either the reaction to the UN weapons inspectors or to the state of diplomatic activity. I just don't believe there's any precedent whatsoever for Secretary of State announcing military operations.
One more call. Marzok in the Bronx. You're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, Brian.
Go ahead.
Show.
Thank you.
My question is, when are we going to say it's enough? Did we know whether the chemical has been used, but who used it? And is Saudi Arabia a democracy? And when Iran was poisoned, where are we? All of a sudden, all this thing come out, and we are kind of, hey, don't know what to do. We are rather to go and then bomb Syria's Assad. Can he just respond to that? Let me hang up and listen.
Marzok, thank you for your call. And let me add to that, since he raises Saudi Arabia, which is a Sunni country that's in favor of the attack, apparently, and, you know, Arab countries seem to be divided. Just as the Democrats and the Republicans in this country seem to be divided. I've been watching with particular interest the debate among conservatives, where you have, for example, the New York Post cover, mocking the Obama administration for being weak and soft, and when are we going to take care of them already? And on the other hand, you have Sean Hannity and Steve Lonergan, the Republican candidate for U.S. Senate in New Jersey, very, very conservative, saying we should absolutely not get involved in this.
Well, you're exactly right. What you have are real fissures within the conservative movement and within the Republican Party. You have the people who are close, say, to Rand Paul, who are kind of foreign policy minimalists, who would prefer that we not do anything. You have those who are quote-unquote neocons, whose criticism of what is that the president, what he's contemplating, is it doesn't go far enough. And then you've got people in between who are relatively supportive of limited action. I think that shows you the range of views now within the Republican Party. There's a similar range of views within the Democratic Party. And in some ways, it highlights the two things. One is that the political debate about foreign policy doesn't neatly align with our political parties. And secondly, there is a large and growing debate about this country's role in the world. Here it is. It's now we're coming up on a quarter century since the end of the Cold War. And there really is intellectual disarray about what the United States is about in the world.
And to the caller's point, do we know what we're unleashing politically by siding against Assad militarily? David Brooks wrote very thoughtfully, I thought, in the New York Times today about the growing regional war between Sunnis and Shiites and Alawites and Shiites, Alawites and Sunnis, and what's going to happen over there is anybody's guess. We know about the al-Qaeda links with some of the rebel groups. Are we really supporting something that's going to be better for U.S. national interests than Assad?
As always, David Brooks is thoughtful, and he's right to raise questions about the potential implications or repercussions of acting. And there's any number of fault lines in the region, as you mentioned, whether it's Sunni, Shia, Persian, Arab, what have you. On the other hand, there's also consequences of not acting, and that's what makes this so tough. And I think what the administration is trying to do is come up with a compromise that does something using direct military force to respond to chemical weapons use, does other things to deal with the humanitarian crisis and the civil war itself in Syria. But David Brooks raises a good set of arguments, and the Middle East may be, and I think this is the case, in what is still the early stages of what could be a prolonged crisis within and between the countries of the region. So for the United States, this is simply going to be one, I think, of a series of enormously difficult decisions about what it is we should be doing, but also not doing. Likely to be no good options or few good options as this plays out.
Richard Haass, president of the Council on Foreign Relations, author of the book Foreign Policy Begins at Home. The debate in the country continues. Maybe Secretary of State Kerry, when he speaks at 12:30 this afternoon, will lay out some of that evidence against the Assad regime on the chemical weapons as they declassify some today, if as expected that happens. And we will see. Richard Haass, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, think you already know who the next New York City mayor will be? Greg David from Crane's New York Business on the sorry history of mayoral primary polls that get it wrong. Stay with us.